It soon became obvious, even within the steadying, that the pattern was growing frail. The sky darkened. Our dead appeared, standing in rings outside the borders of the steading, looking in. Most troublingly, trees fell ill, and no song would heal them. It was in this time of sorrows that I stepped up to the great stump. At first I was forbidden, but my mother, Kavril, demanded I have my chance. I do not know what sparked her change of heart, as she herself had argued quite decisively for the opposing side. My hands shook. I would be the last speaker, and most seemed to have already made up their minds to open the Book of Translation. They considered me an afterthought, and I knew that unless I spoke true, humanity would be left alone to face the shadow. In that moment, my nervousness fled. I felt only a stillness, a calm sense of purpose. I opened my mouth, and I began to speak.
From the Dragon Reborn, by Loyal, son of Arendt, son of Halon, of Steading Shangtai. Prologue. Distinctions. Mandarb's hooves beat a familiar rhythm on a broken ground as Lan Mandragoran rode toward his death. The dry air made his throat rough, and the surface was sprinkled white with crystals of salt that had seeped up from below. Distant red rock formations loomed to the north, where sickness stained them. Blight marks, a creeping dark lichen. He continued riding east, parallel to the blight. This was still Saldaea, where his wife had deposited him, only narrowly keeping her promise to take him to the borderlands. It had stretched before him for a long time, this road. Though he'd turned away from it 20 years ago, agreeing to follow Moiraine, he'd always known he would return. This was what it meant to bear the name of his fathers, the sword on his hip, and the Hadori on his head. This rocky section of northern Saldaea was known as the Proska Flats. It was a grim place to ride. Not a plant grew on it. The wind blew from the north, carrying with it a foul stench, like that of a deep sweltering mire bloated with corpses. The sky overhead stormed dark, brooding. That woman, Lan thought, shaking his head. How quickly Nynaeve had learned to talk and think like an Aes Sedai. Riding to his death didn't hurt him, but the pain of knowing she feared for him, that did hurt. Badly. He hadn't seen another person in days. The Saldaeans had fortifications to the south, but the land here was pocked with broken ravines that made it difficult for Trollocs to assault. They preferred attacking near Maradon. That was no reason to relax, however. One should never relax this close to the Blight. He noted a hilltop. That would be a good place for a scout's post. He made certain to watch it for any sign of movement. He rode around a shallow gulf in the ground, just in case it held waiting ambushers. He kept his hand on his bow. Once he traveled a little farther eastward, he'd cut down into Saldaea and cross Kandor on its good roadways. Then, some gravel rolled down a hillside nearby. Lan carefully slid an arrow from the quiver tied to Mandarb's saddle. Where had the sound come from? To the right, he decided. Southward. The hillside there. Someone was approaching from behind it. Lan did not stop Mandarb. If the hoofbeats changed, it would give warning. He quietly raised the bow, feeling the sweat of his fingers inside his fawn-hide gloves. He knocked the arrow and pulled carefully, raising it to his cheek, breathing in its scent. Goose feathers. Resin. A figure walked around the southern hillside. The man froze, an old shaggy-maned packhorse walking around beside him and continuing on ahead. It stopped only when the rope at its neck grew taut. The man wore a laced tan shirt and dusty breeches. He had a sword at his waist, and his arms were thick and strong, but he didn't look threatening. In fact, he seemed faintly familiar.
Lord Mandragoran,
the man said, hastening forward, pulling his horse after.
I've found you at last. I assumed you'd be traveling the Kremer Road.
Lan lowered his bow and stopped Mandarb.
Do I know you?
I brought supplies, my lord.
The man had black hair and tanned skin. Borderlander stock, probably. He continued forward, overeager, yanking on the overloaded packhorse's rope with a thick-fingered hand.
I figured that you wouldn't have enough food. Tents, four of them, just in case. Some water, too. Feed for the horses, and—
Who are you?
Lan barked.
And how do you know who I am?
The man drew up sharply.
I'm Bulan, my lord. From Kandor?
From Kandor. Lan remembered a gangly young messenger boy. With surprise, he saw the resemblance.
Bulan? That was 20 years ago, man.
I know, Lord Mandragoran. But when word spread in the palace that the Golden Crane was raised, I knew what I had to do. I've learned the sword well, my lord. I've come to ride with you, and—
The word of my travel is spread to Aes Daishar.
Yes, my lord. El Nynaeve, she came to us, you see. Told us what you'd done. Others are gathering, but I left first. Knew you'd need supplies.
Burn that woman,
Lan thought. And she'd made him swear that he would accept those who wished to ride with him. Well, if she could play games with the truth, then so could he. Lan had said he'd take anyone who wished to ride with him. This man was not mounted, therefore Lan could refuse him. A petty distinction, but 20 years with Aes Sedai had taught him a few things about how to watch one's words.
Go back to Aes Daishar, Lan said. Tell them that my wife was wrong, and I have not raised the Golden Crane.
But—
I don't need you, son. Away with you.
Lan's heels nudged Mandarb into a walk, and he passed the man standing on the road. For a few moments, Lan thought that his order would be obeyed, though the avoidance of his oath pricked at his conscience.
My father was Melchieri,
Bulan said from behind. Lan continued on.
He died when I was 5,
Bulan called.
He married a Kandori woman. They both fell to bandits. I don't remember much of them, only something my father told me. That someday we would fight for the Golden Crane. All I have of him is this.
Lan couldn't help but look back as Mandarb continued to walk away. Bulan held up a thin strap of leather, the Hadori, worn on the head of a Melchieri, sworn to fight the Shadow.
I would wear the Hadori of my father,
Bulan called, voice growing louder.
But I have nobody to ask if I may. That is the tradition, is it not? Someone has to give me the right to don it. Well, I would fight the Shadow all my days.
He looked down at the Hadori, then back up again and yelled,
I would stand against the darkness, Elan Mandragoran. Will you tell me I cannot?
Go to the Dragon Reborn,
Lan called to him.
Or to your queen's army. Either of them will take you.
And you? You will ride all the way to the Seven Towers without supplies?
I'll forage.
Pardon me, my lord, but have you seen the land these days? The blight creeps farther and farther south. Nothing grows, even in once fertile lands. Game is scarce.
Lan hesitated. He reined Mandarb in.
All those years ago,
Bulan called, walking forward, his packhorse walking behind him.
I hardly knew who you were, though I knew you lost someone dear to you among us. I've spent years cursing myself for not serving you better. I swore that I would stand with you someday.
He walked up beside Lan.
I ask you because I have no father. May I wear the Hadori and fight at your side, Elan Mandragoran?
My king?
Lan breathed out slowly, stilling his emotions.
Nynaeve, when next I see you.
But he would not see her again, He tried not to dwell upon that. He had made an oath. Aes Sedai wiggled around their promises, but did that give him the same right? No. A man was his honor. He could not deny Bulan.
We ride anonymously, Lan said. We do not raise the Golden Crane. You tell nobody who I am.
Yes, my lord, Bulan said.
Then wear that Hadori with pride, Lan said. Too few keep to the old ways. And yes, you may join me.
Lan nudged Mandarb into motion, Bulan following on foot. And the one became two. Perrin slammed his hammer against the red-hot length of iron. Sparks sprayed into the air like incandescent insects. Sweat beaded on his face. Some people found the clang of metal against metal grating. Not Perrin. That sound was soothing. He raised the hammer and slammed it down. Sparks. Flying chips of light that bounced off his leather vest and his apron. With each strike, the walls of the room, sturdy leather-leaf wood, fuzzed, responding to the beats of metal on metal. He was dreaming, though he wasn't in the wolf dream. He knew this, though he didn't know how he knew. The windows were dark. The only light was that of the deep red fire burning on his right. Two bars of iron simmered in the coals, waiting for their turn at the forge. Perrin slammed the hammer down again. This was peace. This was home. He was making something important, so very important. It was a piece of something larger. The first step to creating something was to figure out its parts. Master Luhan had taught Perrin that on his first day at the forge. You couldn't make a spade without understanding how the handle fit to the blade. You couldn't make a hinge without knowing how the two leaves moved with the pin. You couldn't even make a nail without knowing its parts. Head, shaft, point.
Understand the pieces, Perrin.
A wolf lay in the corner of the room. It was large and grizzled, fur the color of a pale gray riverstone, and scarred from a lifetime of battles and hunts. The wolf laid its head on its paws, watching Perrin. That was natural. Of course there was a wolf in the corner. Why wouldn't there be? It was Hopper. Perrin worked, enjoying the deep, burning heat of the forge, the feel of the sweat trailing down his arms, the scent of the fire. He shaped the length of iron, one blow for every second beat of his heart. The metal never grew cool, but instead retained its malleable red-yellow.
What am I making?
Perrin picked up the length of glowing iron with his tongs. The air warped around it.
Pound, pound, pound,
Hopper sent, communicating in images and scents.
Like a pup jumping at butterflies.
Hopper didn't see the point of reshaping metal, and found it amusing that men did such things. To a wolf, a thing was what it was. Why go through so much effort to change it into something else? Perrin set the length of iron aside. It cooled immediately, fading from yellow to orange to crimson to a dull black. Perrin had pounded it into a misshapen nugget, perhaps the size of two fists. Master Luhan would be ashamed to see such shoddy work. Perrin needed to discover what he was making soon before his master returned. No, that was wrong. The dream shook and the walls grew misty.
I'm not an apprentice.
Perrin raised a thick gloved hand to his head.
I'm not in the Two Rivers any longer. I'm a man. A married man.
Perrin grabbed the lump of unshaped iron with his tongs, thrusting it down on the anvil. It flared to life with heat.
Everything is still wrong.
Perrin smashed his hammer down.
It should all be better now, but it isn't. It seems worse somehow.
He continued pounding. He hated those rumors that the men in camp whispered about him. Perrin had been sick and Berylaine had cared for him. That was the end of it. But still, those whispers continued. He slammed his hammer down over and over. Sparks flew in the air like splashes of water, far too many to come from one length of iron. But he gave one final beat, then breathed in and out. The lump hadn't changed. Perrin growled and grabbed the tongs, setting the lump aside and taking a fresh bar from the coals. He had to finish this piece. It was so important. But what was he making? He started pounding. I need to spend time with Fail to figure things out, remove the awkwardness between us. But there's no time. Those light-blinded fools around him couldn't take care of themselves. Nobody in the Two Rivers ever needed a lord before. He worked for a time, then held up the second chunk of iron. It cooled, turning into a misshapen, flattened length about as long as his forearm. Another shoddy piece. He set it aside.
If you are unhappy, Hopper sent, take your she and leave. If you do not wish to lead the pack, another will.
The wolf's sending came as images of running across open fields, stalks of grain brushing along his snout. An open sky, a cool breeze, a thrill and lust for adventure. The sense of new rain, of wild pastures. Perrin reached his tongs into the coals for the final bar of iron. It burned a distant, dangerous yellow.
I can't leave.
He held the bar up toward the wolf.
It would mean giving in to being a wolf. It would mean losing myself. I won't do that.
He held the near molten steel between them, and Hopper watched it, yellow pinpricks of light reflecting in the wolf's eyes. This dream was so odd. In the past, Perrin's ordinary dreams and the wolf dream had been separate. What did this blending mean? Perrin was afraid. He'd come to a precarious truce with the wolf inside of him. Growing too close to the wolves was dangerous, but that hadn't prevented him turning to them when seeking Fail. Anything for Fail. In doing so, Perrin had nearly gone mad, and had even tried to kill Hopper. Perrin wasn't nearly as in control as he'd assumed. The wolf within him could still reign. Hopper yawned, letting his tongue loll. He smelled of sweet amusement.
This is not funny.
Perrin set the final bar aside without working on it. It cooled, taking on the shape of a thin rectangle, not unlike the beginnings of a hinge.
Problems are not amusing, young bull,
Hopper agreed.
But you are climbing back and forth over the same wall. Come, let us run.
Wolves lived in the moment. Though they remembered the past and seemed to have an odd sense for the future, they didn't worry about either. Not as men did. Wolves ran free, chasing the winds. To join them would be to ignore pain, sorrow, and frustration. To be free. That freedom would cost Perrin too much. He'd lose Fail, would lose his very self. He didn't want to be a wolf. He wanted to be a man.
Is there a way to reverse what has happened to me? Reverse?
Hopper cocked his head. To go backward was not a way of wolves.
Can I?
Perrin struggled to explain.
Can I run so far that the wolves cannot hear me?
Hopper seemed confused. No. Confused did not convey the pained sendings that came from Hopper. Nothingness, the scent of rotting meat, wolves howling in agony. Being cut off was not a thing Hopper could conceive. Perrin's mind grew fuzzy. Why had he stopped forging? He had to finish. Master Luhan would be disappointed. Those lumps were terrible. He should hide them, create something else, show he was capable. He could forge. Couldn't he? A hissing came from behind him. Perrin turned, surprised to see that one of the quenching barrels beside the hearth was boiling.
Of course, he thought. The first pieces I finished. I dropped them in there.
Suddenly anxious, Perrin grabbed his tongs and reached into the turbulent water, steam engulfing his face. He found something at the bottom and brought it out with his tongs. A chunk of white-hot metal. The glow faded. The chunk was actually a small steel figurine in the shape of a tall, thin man with a sword tied to his back. Each line on the figure was detailed, the ruffles on the shirt, the leather bands on the hilt of the tiny sword. But the face was distorted, the mouth open in a twisted scream.
Aram, Perrin thought. His name was Aram.
Perrin couldn't show this to Master Luhan. Why had he created such a thing? The figurine's mouth opened farther, screaming soundlessly. Perrin cried out, dropping it from the tongs and jumping back. The figurine fell to the wood floor and shattered.
Why do you think so much about that one?
Hopper yawned a wide-jawed wolf yawn, tongue curling.
It is common that a young pup challenges the pack leader. He was foolish, and you defeated him.
No, Perrin whispered. It is not common for humans. Not for friends.
The wall of the forge suddenly melted away, becoming smoke. It felt natural for that to happen. Outside, Perrin saw an open, daylit street. A city with broken-windowed shops.
Malden, Perrin said.
A smoky, translucent image of himself stood outside. The image wore no coat. His bare arms bulged with muscles. He kept his beard short, but it made him look older, more intense. Did Perrin really look that imposing? A squat fortress of a man with golden eyes that seemed to glow, carrying a gleaming half-moon axe as large as a man's head. There was something wrong about that axe. Perrin stepped out of the smithy, passing through the shadowy version of himself. When he did, he became that image, axe heavy in his hand, work clothes vanishing, and battle gear replacing it. He took off running. Yes, this was Malden. There were Aiel in the streets. He'd lived this battle, though he was much calmer this time. Before, he'd been lost in the thrill of fighting and of seeking Fael. He stopped in the street.
This is wrong. I carried my hammer into Malden. I threw the axe away.
A horn or a hoof, young bull? Does it matter which one you use to hunt?
Hopper was sitting in the sunlit street beside him.
Yes, it matters. It does to me.
And yet you use them the same way.
A pair of Shido Aiel appeared around a corner. They were watching something to the left, something Perrin couldn't see. He ran to attack them. He sheared through the chin of one, then swung the spike on the axe into the chest of the other. It was a brutal, terrible attack, and all three of them ended on the ground. It took several stabs from the spike to kill the second Shido. Perrin stood up. He did remember killing those two Aiel, though he had done it with hammer and knife. He didn't regret their deaths. Sometimes a man needed to fight, and that was that. Death was terrible, but that didn't stop it from being necessary. In fact, it had been wonderful to clash with the Aiel. He'd felt like a wolf on the hunt. When Perrin fought, he came close to becoming someone else. And that was dangerous. He looked accusingly at Hopper, who lounged on a street corner.
Why are you making me dream this?
Making you? Hopper asked. This is not my dream, young bull. Do you see my jaws on your neck, forcing you to think it?
Perrin's axe streamed with blood. He knew what was coming next. He turned. From behind, Aram approached, murder in his eyes. Half of the former tinker's face was coated in blood, and it dripped from his chin, staining his red-striped coat. Aram swung his sword for Perrin's neck, the steel hissing in the air. Perrin stepped back. He refused to fight the boy again. The shadowy version of himself split off, leaving the real Perrin in his blacksmith's clothing. The shadow exchanged blows with Aram.
The prophet explained it to me. You're really shadow spawn. I have to rescue the Lady Fael from you.
The shadowy Perrin changed, suddenly, into a wolf. It leaped, fur nearly as dark as that of a shadow brother, and ripped out Aram's throat.
No, it didn't happen like that.
It is a dream, Hopper sent.
But I didn't kill him,
Perrin protested.
Samael shot him with arrows right before...
Right before Aram would have killed Perrin.
The horn, the hoof, or the tooth,
Hopper sent, turning and ambling toward a building. Its walls vanished, revealing Master Luhan's smithy inside.
Does it matter? The dead are dead. Two legs do not come here, not usually once they die. I do not know where it is that they go.
Perrin looked down at Aram's body.
I should have taken that fool's sword from him the moment he picked it up. I should have sent him back to his family.
Does not a cub deserve his fangs?
Hopper asked, genuinely confused.
Why would you pull them?
It is a thing of men, Perrin said.
Things of two legs, of men. Always it is a thing of men to you. What of things of wolves?
I am not a wolf.
Hopper entered the forge and Perrin reluctantly followed. The barrel was still boiling. The wall returned and Perrin was once again wearing his leather vest and apron, holding his tongs. He stepped over and pulled out another figurine. This one was in the shape of Tad-el-Kar. As it cooled, Perrin found that the face wasn't distorted like Aram's, though the lower half of the figurine was unformed, still a block of metal. The figurine continued to glow, faintly reddish, after Perrin set it down on the floor. He thrust his tongs back into the water and pulled free a figure of Jory Conger, then one of Aziel Thone. Perrin went to the bubbling barrel time and time again, pulling out figurine after figurine. After the Way of Dreams, fetching them all took both a brief second and what seemed like hours. When he finished, hundreds of figurines stood on the floor facing him, watching. Each steel figure was lit with a tiny fire inside, as if waiting to feel the forger's hammer. But figurines like this wouldn't be forged. They'd be cast.
What does it mean?
Perrin sat down on a stool.
Mean?
Hopper opened his mouth in a wolf laugh.
It means there are many little men on the floor, none of which you can eat. Your kind is too fond of rocks and what is inside of them.
The figurines seemed accusing. Around them lay the broken shards of Aram. Those pieces seemed to be growing larger. The shattered hands began working, clawing on the ground. The shards all became little hands, climbing toward Perrin, reaching for him. Perrin gasped, leaping to his feet. He heard laughter in the distance, ringing closer, shaking the building. Hopper jumped, slamming into him. And then... Perrin started awake. He was back in his tent, in the field where they'd been camped for a few days now. They'd run across a bubble of evil the week before that had caused angry, red, oily serpents to wiggle from the ground all through camp. Several hundred were sick from their bites. Aes Sedai healing had been enough to keep most of them alive, but not restore them completely. Fael slept beside Perrin, peaceful. Outside, one of his men tapped a post to count off the hour. Three taps. Still hours until dawn. Perrin's heart pounded softly and he raised a hand to his bare chest. He half expected an army of tiny metal hands to crawl out from beneath his bedroll. Eventually, he forced his eyes closed and tried to relax. This time, sleep was very elusive.
Grendahl sipped at her wine, which glistened in a goblet trimmed with a web of silver around the sides. The goblet had been crafted with drops of blood caught in a ring pattern inside the crystal, frozen forever, tiny bubbles of brilliant red. "We should be doing something," Arangar said, lounging on the chaise and eyeing one of Grendahl's pets with a predatory hunger as he passed. "I don't know how you stand it, staying so far from important events, like some scholar holed up in a dusty corner." Grendahl arched an eyebrow. "A scholar? In some dusty corner?" Natrin's barrow was modest compared to some palaces she had known during the previous age, but it was hardly a hovel. The furnishings were fine, the walls bearing an arching pattern of thick dark hardwoods, the marble of the floor sparkling with inset chips of mother-of-pearl and inlaid gold. Arangar was just trying to provoke her. Grendahl put the irritation out of her mind. The fire burned low in the hearth, but the balcony doors, leading out onto a fortified walkway 3 stories in the air, were open, letting in a crisp mountain breeze. She rarely left a window or door open to the outside, but today she liked the contrast. Warmth from one side, a cool breeze from the other. "Life was about feeling, touches on your skin, both passionate and icy. Anything other than the normal, the average, the lukewarm." "Are you listening to me?" Arangar asked. "I always listen," Grendahl said, setting aside her goblet as she sat on her own chaise. She wore a golden enveloping dress, sheer, but buttoned to the neck. What marvelous fashions these Domani had, ideal for teasing while revealing. "I loathe being so removed from things," Arangar continued. "This age is exciting. Primitive people can be so interesting." The voluptuous ivory-skinned woman arched her back, stretching arms toward the wall. "We're missing all of the excitement." "Excitement is best viewed from a distance," Grendahl said. "I would think you'd understand that." Arangar fell silent. The great lord had not been pleased with her for losing control of Egwene Alvear. "Well," Arangar said, standing, "if that is your thought on it, I will seek more interesting evening sport." Her voice was cool. Perhaps their alliance was wearing thin. In that case, it was time for reinforcement. Grendahl opened herself and accepted the great lord's dominance of her, feeling the thrilling ecstasy of his power, his passion, his very substance. It was so much more intoxicating than the one power, this raging torrent of fire. It threatened to overwhelm and consume her, and despite being filled with the true power, she could channel only a thin trickle of it, a gift given her by Moradin. No, by the great lord. Best not to begin associating those two in her mind. For now, Moradin was nameless. For now only. Grendahl wove a ribbon of air. Working with the true power was similar, yet not identical, to working with the one power. A weave of the true power would often function in a slightly different way, or have an unanticipated side effect. And there were some weaves that could only be crafted by the true power. The great lord's essence forced the pattern, straining it and leaving it scarred. Even something the creator had designed to be eternal could be unraveled using the Dark One's energies. It bespoke an eternal truth, something as close to being sacred as Grendahl was willing to accept. Whatever the creator could build, the Dark One could destroy. She snaked her ribbon of air through the room toward Arangar. The other chosen had stepped out onto the balcony. Grendahl forbade the creation of gateways inside, lest they damage her pets or her furnishings. Grendahl lifted the ribbon of air up to Arangar's cheek and caressed it delicately. Arangar froze. She turned, suspicious, but it took only a moment for her eyes to open wide. She wouldn't have felt the goosebumps on her arms to indicate Grendahl was channeling. The true power gave no hint, no sign. Male or female, no one could see or sense the weaves. Not unless he or she had been granted the privilege of channeling the true power. What? The woman asked. How? Moradin is nameless, Grendahl said. Yes. But once the Great Lord's favor in this regard was not confined to the nameless. She continued to caress Arangar's cheek, and the woman flushed. Arangar, like the other chosen, lusted for the true power while fearing it at the same time. Dangerous, pleasurable, seductive. When Grendahl withdrew her line of air, Arangar stepped back into the room and returned to her chaise, then sent one of Grendahl's pets to fetch her toy Aes Sedai. Lust still burned Arangar's cheeks. Likely she would use Delanna to distract herself. Arangar seemed to find it amusing to force the homely Aes Sedai into subservience. Delanna arrived moments later. She always remained nearby. The Shinaran woman was pale-haired and stout, with thick limbs. Grendahl's lips turned down. Such an unpretty thing. Not like Arangar herself. She'd have made an ideal pet. Maybe someday Grendahl would have the chance to make her into one. Arangar and Delanna began to exchange affections on the chaise. Arangar was insatiable, a fact Grendahl had exploited on numerous occasions, the lure of the true power being only the latest. Of course, Grendahl enjoyed pleasures herself, but she made certain that people thought she was far more self-indulgent than she was. If you knew what people expected you to be, you could use those expectations. Grendahl froze as an alarm went off in her ears, the sound of crashing waves beating against one another. Arangar continued her pleasures. She couldn't hear the sound. The weave was very specific, placed where her servants could trip it to give her warning. Grendahl climbed to her feet, strolling around the side of the room, giving no indication of urgency. At the door, she sent a few of her pets in to help distract Arangar. Best to discover the scope of the problem before involving her. Grendahl walked down a hallway hung with golden chandeliers and ornamented with mirrors. She was halfway down a stairwell when Garamond, the captain of her palace guard, came bustling up. He was Saldaean, a distant cousin of the queen, and wore a thick mustache on his lean, handsome face. Compulsion had made him utterly loyal, of course.
"Great lady," he said, panting. "A man has been captured approaching the palace. My men recognize him as a minor lord from Bandar Aban, a member of House Ramshalan."
Grendahl frowned, then waved for Garamond to follow as she made her way to one of her audience chambers, a small windowless room decorated in crimson. She wove a ward against eavesdropping, then sent Garamond to bring the intruder. Soon he returned with some guards and a Damani man dressed in bright greens and blues, a beauty mark shaped like a bell on his cheek. His neat short beard was tied with tiny bells, and they jingled as the guards shoved him forward. He brushed off his arms, glaring at the soldiers, and straightened his ruffled shirt.
"Am I to understand that I have been delivered to—"
He cut off with a choking sound as Grendahl wrapped him in weaves of air and dug into his mind. He stuttered, eyes growing unfocused.
"I am Pikor Ramshalan," he said in a monotone. "I have been sent by the Dragon Reborn to seek an alliance with the merchant family residing in this fortification. As I am smarter and more clever than Al-Thor, he needs me to build alliances for him. He is particularly afraid of those living in this palace, which I find ridiculous, since it is distant and unimportant. Obviously, the Dragon Reborn is a weak man. I believe that by gaining his confidence, I can be chosen as the next king of Arad-Doman. I wish for you to make an alliance with me, not with him, and will promise you favors once I am king. Grendel waved a hand, and he cut off in mid-word. She folded her arms, hairs bristling as she shivered. The dragon reborn had found her. He had sent a distraction for her. He thought he could manipulate her. She instantly wove a gateway to one of her most secure hiding places. Cool air wafted in from an area of the world where it was morning, not early evening. Best to be careful. Best to flee. And yet, she hesitated.
He must know pain. He must know frustration. He must know anguish. Bring these to him. You will be rewarded.
Arangar had fled from her place among Aes Sedai, foolishly allowing herself to be sensed, channeling Sidene. She still bore punishment for her failure. If Grendel left now, discarding a chance to twist Al'Thor about himself, would she be similarly punished? "What is this?" Arangar's voice asked outside. "Let me through, you fools." "Grendel? What are you doing?" Grendel hissed softly, then closed the gateway and composed herself. She nodded for Arangar to be allowed into the room. The lithe woman stepped up to the doorway, eyeing and assessing Ramchalan. Grendel shouldn't have sent the pets to her. The move had likely made her suspicious. "Al'Thor has found me," Grendel said curtly. "He sent this one to make an alliance with me, but did not tell him who I was. Al'Thor likely wants me to think that this man stumbled upon me accidentally." Arangar pursed her lips. "So you'll flee? Run from the center of excitement again? This from you? I was surrounded by enemies. Flight was my only option." It sounded like a practiced line. Words like those were a challenge. Arangar would serve her. Perhaps. "Does that Aes Sedai of yours know compulsion?" Arangar shrugged. "She's been trained in it. She's passably skilled. Fetch her." Arangar raised an eyebrow but nodded in deference, disappearing to run the errand herself, probably to gain time to think. Grendel sent a servant for one of her dove cages. They arrived with the bird before Arangar was back, and Grendel carefully wove the true power, once again thrilling in the rush of holding it, and crafted a complex weave of spirit. Could she remember how to do this? It had been so long. She overlaid the weave on the bird's mind. Her vision seemed to snap. In a moment she could see two images in front of her, the world as she saw it, and a shadowed version of what the bird saw. If she focused, she could turn her attention to one or the other. It made her mind hurt. The vision of a bird was entirely different from that of a human being. She could see a much larger field, and the colors were so vivid as to be nearly blinding, but she had trouble focusing and judging distance. She tucked the bird's sight into the back of her head. A dove would be unobtrusive, but using one was far more difficult than a raven or a rat, the Dark One's own favorite eyes. The weave worked better on those than it did on other animals, though most vermin that watched for the Dark One had to report back before he knew what they'd seen. Why that was, she was not certain. The intricacies of the True Power's special weaves never had made much sense to her. Not as much as they had to Aginor, at least. Arangar returned with her Aes Sedai, who was looking increasingly timid these days. She curtsied low to Grendel, then remained in a subservient posture. Grendel carefully removed her compulsion from Ramchalan, leaving him dazed and disoriented. "What is it you wish me to do, Great One?" Delana asked, glancing at Arangar and then back at Grendel. "Compulsion," Grendel said,
as intricate and as complex as you can make it.
What do you wish it to do, great lady?
Leave him able to act like himself, Grendahl said, but remove all memory of events here. Replace them with a memory of talking to a merchant family and securing their alliance. Add a few other random requirements on him. Whatever occurs to you. Delana frowned, but she had learned not to question the chosen. Grendahl folded her arms and tapped one finger as she watched the Aes Sedai work. She felt increasingly nervous. Althor knew where she was. Would he attack? No, he wouldn't harm women. That particular failing was an important one. It meant she had time to respond, didn't she? How had he managed to trace her to this palace? She had covered herself perfectly. The only minions she'd let out of her sight were under compulsion so heavy that it would kill them to remove it. Could it be that the Aes Sedai he kept with him, Nynaeve, the woman gifted in healing, had been able to undermine and read Grendahl's weaves? Grendahl needed time, and she needed to discover what Althor knew. If Nynaeve Almira had the skill needed to read compulsions, that was dangerous. Grendahl needed to lay him a false trail, delay him. Hence her requirement that Delana create a thick compulsion with strange provisions in it. Bring him agony. Grendahl could do that. You next, she said to Arangar, once Delana had finished. Something convoluted. I want Althor and his Aes Sedai to find the touch of a man on the mind. That would confuse them further. Arangar shrugged, but did as asked, laying down a thick and complex compulsion on the unfortunate Ramshalan's mind. He was somewhat pretty. Did Althor assume she'd want him for one of his pets? Did he even remember enough of being Luz Theron to know that about her? Her reports on how much of his old life he remembered were contradictory, but he seemed to be recalling more and more. That was what worried her. Luz Theron could have tracked her to this palace, perhaps. She'd never expected that Althor would be able to do the same. Arangar finished. Now, Grendahl said, releasing her weaves of air and speaking to Ramshalan. Return and tell the Dragon Reborn of your success here. Ramshalan blinked, shaking his head.
Yes, my lady. Yes, I believe the ties we made today will be extremely beneficial to both of us.
He smiled, weak-minded fool.
Perhaps we should dine and drink to our success, Lady Basine. It has been a wearying trip to see you, and I go, Grendahl said coldly. Very well. You will be rewarded when I am king.
Her guards led him away, and he began whistling with a self-satisfied air. Grendahl sat down and closed her eyes. Several of her soldiers stepped over to guard her, their boots soft on the thick rug. She looked through the dove's eyes, accustoming herself to its strange way of seeing. At her order, a servant picked it up and carried it to a window in the hallway outside the room. The bird hopped onto the windowsill. Grendahl gave it a soft nudge to go forward. She wasn't practiced enough to take control completely. Flying was far more difficult than it looked. The dove flapped out of the window. The sun was lowering beneath the mountains, outlining them in angry red and orange, and the lake below fell into a deep, shadowy blue-black. The view was thrilling but nauseating as the dove soared up into the air and landed on one of the towers. Ramshalan eventually walked out of the gates below. Grendahl nudged the dove and it leapt off the tower, plunging toward the ground. Grendahl gritted her teeth at the stomach-churning descent, the palace stoneworks becoming a blur. The dove leveled out and flapped after Ramshalan. He seemed to be grumbling to himself, though she could make out only rudimentary sounds through the dove's unfamiliar earholes. She followed him for some time through the darkening woods.
An owl would have been better, but she didn't have one captive. She chided herself for that. The dove flew from branch to branch. The forest floor was a messy tangle of underbrush and fallen pine needles. She found that distinctly unpleasant. There was light up ahead. It was faint, but the dove's eyes could easily pick out light and shadow, motion and stillness. She nudged it to investigate, leaving Ramshalan. The light was coming from a gateway in the middle of a clear patch, spilling forth a warm glow. There were figures standing before it. One of them was Al-Thor. Grendel felt instant panic. He was here, looking down over the ridge toward her. Darkness within. She hadn't known for certain if he'd be here in person, or if Ramshalan would travel through a gateway to give his report. What game was Al-Thor playing? She landed her dove on a branch. Arengar was complaining and asking Grendel what she was seeing. She'd seen the dove and would know what Grendel was up to. Grendel concentrated harder. The dragon reborn, the man who had once been Luz Theron Telamon. He knew where she was. He had once hated her deeply. How much did he remember? Did he recall her murder of Yanet? Althor's tame Aiel brought Ramshalan forward, and Nynaeve inspected him. Yes, that Nynaeve did seem to be able to read compulsion. She knew what to look for, at least. She would have to die. Al-Thor relied upon her. Her death would bring him pain. And after her, Al-Thor's dark-haired lover. Grendel nudged the dove down onto a lower branch. What would Al-Thor do? Grendel's instinct said he wouldn't dare move, not until he unraveled her plot. He acted the same now as he had during her age. He liked to plan, to spend time building to a crescendo of an assault. She frowned. What was he saying? She strained, trying to make sense of the sounds. Cursed bird's ear holes. The voices sounded like croaks. Kalendor? Why was he talking about Kalendor? And a box? Something burst alight in his hand. The access key. Grendel gasped. He'd brought that with him? It was nearly as bad as balefire. Suddenly she understood. She'd been played. Cold, terrified, she released the dove and snapped her eyes open. She was still sitting in the small, windowless room, Arengar leaning beside the doorway with arms folded. Al-Thor had sent Ramshalan in, expecting him to be captured, expecting him to have compulsion placed on him. Ramshalan's only purpose was to give Al-Thor confirmation that Grendel was in the tower. Light! How clever he's become! She released the true power and embraced less wonderful Sidar. Quickly, she was so unsettled that her embrace nearly failed. She was sweating. Go! She had to go! She opened a new gateway. Arengar turned, staring through the walls in the direction of Al-Thor. So much power! What is he doing? Arengar. She and Delana had made the weaves of compulsion. Al-Thor must think Grendel dead. If he destroyed the place and those compulsions remained, Al-Thor would know that he'd missed and that Grendel lived. Grendel formed two shields and slammed them into place, one for Arengar, one for Delana. The women gasped. Grendel tied off the weaves and bound the two in air. Grendel, Arengar said, voice panicked. What are you? It was coming. Grendel leaped for the gateway, rolling through it, tumbling and ripping her dress on a branch. A blinding light rose behind her. She struggled to dismiss the gateway and caught one glimpse of the horrified Arengar before everything behind was consumed in beautiful, pure whiteness. The gateway vanished, leaving Grendel in darkness. She lay, heart beating at a terrible speed, nearly blinded by the glare. She'd made the quickest gateway she could. one that led only a short distance away. She lay in the dirty underbrush atop a ridge behind the palace. A wave of wrongness washed over her, a warping in the air, the pattern itself rippling. A Baal scream, it was called, a moment when creation itself howled in pain. She breathed in and out, trembling, but she had to see, she had to know. She rose to her feet, left ankle twisted. She hobbled to the tree line and looked down. Natrin's barrow, the entire palace, was gone, burned out of the pattern. She couldn't see Althor on his distant ridge, but she knew where he was.
"You," she growled. "You have become far more dangerous than I assumed."
Hundreds of beautiful men and women, the finest she'd gathered, gone. Her stronghold, dozens of items of power, her greatest ally among the chosen, gone. This was a disaster. "No," she thought, "I live." She'd anticipated him, if only by a few moments. Now he would think she was dead. She was suddenly the safest she'd been since escaping the Dark One's prison. Except, of course, that she'd just caused the death of one of the chosen. The Great Lord would not be pleased. She limped away from the ridge, already planning her next move. This would have to be handled very, very carefully.
Galad Damodred, Lord Captain Commander of the Children of the Light, yanked his booted foot free of the ankle-deep mud with a slurping sound. Bite-me's buzzed in the muggy air. The stench of mud and stagnant water threatened to gag him with each breath as he led his horse to drier ground on the path. Behind him walked a long, twisting column, four men wide, each one as muddied, sweaty, and weary as he was. They were on the border of Gildan and Altara, in a swampy wetland where the oaks and spicewoods had given way to laurels and spidery cypress, their gnarled roots spread like spindly fingers. The stinking air was hot, despite the shade and cloud cover, and thick. It was like breathing in foul soup. Galad steamed beneath his breastplate and mail, his conical helmet hanging from his saddle, his skin itching from the grime and salty sweat. Miserable though it was, this route was the best way. Asinawa would not anticipate it. Galad wiped his brow with the back of his hand and tried to walk with head high for the benefit of those who followed him. 7,000 men, children who had chosen him rather than the Shonchan invaders. Dull green moss hung from the branches, drooping like shreds of flesh from rotting corpses. Here and there, the sickly grays and greens were relieved by a bright burst of tiny pink or violet flowers, growing up around trickling streams. Their sudden color was unexpected, as if someone had sprinkled drops of paint on the ground. It was strange to find beauty in this place. Could he find the light in his own situation as well? He feared it would not be so easy. He tugged Stout forward. He could hear worried conversations from behind, punctuated by the occasional curse. This place, with its stench and biting insects, would try the best of men. Those who followed Galad were unnerved by the place the world was becoming. A world where the sky was constantly clouded black, where good men died to strange twistings of the pattern, and where Valda, the Lord Captain Commander before Galad, had turned out to be a murderer and a rapist. Galad shook his head. The last battle would soon come. A clinking of chain mail announced someone moving up the line. Galad glanced over his shoulder as Dane Bornhald arrived, saluted, and fell into place beside him.
"Damodred," Dane said softly, their boots squishing in mud. "Perhaps we should turn back."
"Backward leads only to the past," Galad said, scanning the pathway ahead.
"I have thought about this much, Child Bornhald. This sky, the wasting of the land, the way the dead walk.
There is no longer time to find allies and war against the Shonchan. We must march to the last battle.
But this swamp, Bornhold said, glancing to the side as a large serpent slid through the underbrush.
Our maps say we should be out of it by now.
Then surely we are near the edge.
Perhaps, Dane said, a trail of sweat dripping from his brow and down the side of his lean face, which twitched. Fortunately, he'd run out of brandy a few days back.
Unless the map is in error.
Galad didn't respond. Once good maps were proving faulty these days, open fields would turn to broken hills, villages would vanish, pastures would be arable one day, then suddenly overgrown with vines and fungus. The swamp could indeed have spread.
The men are exhausted, Bornhold said. They're good men, you know they are. But they are starting to complain.
He winced as if anticipating a reprimand from Galad. Perhaps once he would have given one. The children should bear their afflictions with pride. However, memories of lessons Morghese had taught, lessons he hadn't understood in his youth, were nagging at him. Lead by example. Require strength, but first show it. Galad nodded. They were nearing a dry clearing.
Gather the men. I will speak to those at the front. Have my words recorded, then pass to those behind.
Bornhold looked perplexed, but did as commanded. Galad stepped off to the side, climbing up a small hill. He placed his hand on the hilt of his sword, inspecting his men as the companies at the front gathered around. They stood with slouched postures, legs muddied, hands flailed at bite-mes or scratched at collars.
"We are children of the light," Galad announced once they were gathered. "These are the darkest days of men. Days when hope is weak. Days when death reigns. But it is on the deepest nights when light is most glorious. During the day, a brilliant beacon can appear weak. But when all other lights fail, it will guide. We are that beacon. This mire is an affliction. But we are the children of the light. And our afflictions are our strength. We are hunted by those who should love us, and other pathways lead to our graves. And so we will go forward, for those we must protect, for the last battle, for the light. Where is the victory of this swamp? I refuse to feel its bite, for I am proud. Proud to live in these days, proud to be part of what is to come. All the lives that came before us in this age looked forward to our day, the day when men will be tested. Let others bemoan their fate. Let others cry and wail. We will not, for we will face this test with heads held high, and we will let it prove us strong.
Not a long speech. He did not wish to extend their time in the swamp overly much. Still, it seemed to do its duty. The men's backs straightened, and they nodded. Men who had been chosen to do so wrote down the words and moved back to read them to those who had not been able to hear. When the troop continued forward, the men's footsteps no longer dragged, their postures were no longer slumped. Galad remained on his hillside, taking a few reports, letting the men see him as they passed. When the last of the 7,000 had gone by, Galad noted a small group waiting at the base of the hill. Child Jarrett Bayar stood with them, looking up at Galad, sunken eyes alight with zeal. He was gaunt, with a narrow face.
Child Bayar, Galad said, walking down from the hillside. It was a good speech, my lord captain commander, Bayar said fervently. The last battle. Yes, it is time to go to it.
It is our burden, Galad said, and our duty.
We will ride northward, Bayar said. Men will come to us, and we will grow. An enormous force of the children. Tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. We will wash over the land. Maybe we will have enough men to cast down the White Tower and the witches, rather than needing to ally with them.
Galad shook his head.
We will need the Aes Sedai, Child Bayar. The Shadow will have dreadlords, Murdrol, Forsaken,
Yes, I suppose.
Biar seemed reluctant. Well, he'd seemed reluctant about the idea before, but he had agreed to it.
Our road is difficult, Child Biar. But the Children of the Light will be leaders at the Lost Battle.
Bolda's misdeeds had tarnished the entire order. More than that, Galad was increasingly convinced that Asunawa had played a large role in the mistreatment and death of his stepmother. That meant the High Inquisitor himself was corrupt. Doing what was right was the most important thing in life. It required any sacrifice. At this time, the right thing to do was flee. Galad could not face Asunawa. The High Inquisitor was backed by the Seanchan. Besides, the last battle was more important. Galad stepped swiftly, walking through the muck back toward the front of the line of children. They traveled light, with few pack animals, and his men wore their armor. Their mounts were laden with food and supplies. At the front, Galad found Trom speaking with a few men who wore leathers and brown cloaks, not white tabards and steel caps. They're scouts. Trom nodded to him in respect. The Lord Captain was one of Galad's most trusted men.
Scouts say there's a small issue ahead, my Lord Captain Commander, Trom said. What issue?
It would be best to show it to you directly, sir, said Child Barlet, the leader of the scouts.
Galad nodded him forward. Ahead, the swampy forest seemed to be thinning. Thank the light. Did that mean they were nearly free? No. As Galad arrived, he found several other scouts looking out at a dead forest. Most trees in the swamp bore leaves, though sickly ones, but those ahead were skeletal and ashen, as if burned. There was some kind of sickly white lichen or moss growing over everything. The tree trunks looked emaciated. Water flooded this area, a wide but shallow river with a very slow current. It had swallowed the bases of many of the trees, and fallen tree limbs broke the dirty brown water like arms reaching toward the sky.
There are corpses, my Lord Captain Commander, one of the scouts said, gesturing upriver. Floating down. Looks like the remnants of a distant battle.
Is this river on our maps? Galad asked.
One by one, the scouts shook their heads. Galad set his jaw.
Can this be forded?
It's shallow, my Lord Captain Commander, Child Barlet said. But we'll have to watch for hidden depths.
Galad reached out to a tree beside him and broke free a long branch, the wood snapping loudly.
I will go first. Have the men stow their armor and cloaks.
The orders went down the line, and Galad took off his armor and wrapped it in his cloak, then tied it to his back. He hiked up his trousers as far as he could, then stepped down the gentle bank and plowed forward into the murky water. The sharply cold spring runoff made him tense. His boots sank inches into the sandy bottom, filling with water, stirring up swirls of mud. Stout made a louder splash as he stepped into the water behind. It wasn't too difficult to walk in. The water only came up to his knees. He used his stick to find the best footing. Those skeletal, dying trees were unnerving. They didn't seem to be rotting, and now that he was closer, he could better see the ash-gray fuzz among the lichen that coated their trunks and branches. The children behind splashed loudly as more and more of them entered the wide stream. Nearby, bulbous forms floated down the river to catch upon rocks. Some were the corpses of men, but many were larger. Mules, he realized, catching a better look at a snout.
Dozens of them.
They'd been dead for some time, judging by the bloat. Likely a village upstream had been attacked for its food. This wasn't the first group of dead they'd found. He reached the other side of the river, then climbed out. As he unrolled his trouser legs and donned his armor and cloak, he felt his shoulder aching from the blows Balda had given him. His thigh still stung, too. He turned and continued down the game trail northward, leading the way as other children reached the bank. He longed to ride Stout, but he dared not. Though they were out of the river, the ground was still damp, uneven, and pocked with hidden sinkholes. If he rode, he could easily earn Stout a broken leg and himself a broken crown. So he and his men walked, surrounded by those gray trees, sweating in the miserable heat. He longed for a good bath. Eventually, Trom jogged up the line to him.
All the men are across safely. He checked the sky. Burn those clouds. I can never tell what time it is.
4 hours past midday, Galad said.
You're certain?
Yes.
Weren't we to stop at midday to discuss our next step?
That meeting was to have taken place once they got through the swamp.
For now, we have few choices, Galad said. I will lead the men northward to Andor. The children have met hostility there. I have some secluded land up in the northwest. I will not be turned away there, regardless of who controls the throne.
Light send that Elaine held the Lion Throne. Light send that she had escaped the tangles of the Aes Sedai, though he feared the worst. There were many who would use her as a pawn, Althor not the least of them. She was headstrong, and that could make her easy to manipulate.
We'll need supplies, Trom said. Forage is difficult, and more villages are empty.
Galad nodded, a legitimate concern.
It's a good plan, though, Trom said, then lowered his voice.
I'll admit, Damodred, I worried that you'd refuse leadership. I could not. To abandon the children now, after killing their leader, would be wrong.
Trom smiled.
It's as simple as that to you, isn't it? It should be as simple as that to anyone.
Galad had to rise to the station he had been given. He had no other option.
The last battle comes, and the Children of the Light will fight. Even if we have to make alliances with the Dragon Reborn himself, we will fight.
For some time, Galad hadn't been certain about Althor. Certainly the Dragon Reborn would have to fight at the last battle. But was that man Althor, or was he a puppet of the Tower, and not the true Dragon Reborn? That sky was too dark, the land too broken. Althor must be the Dragon Reborn. That didn't mean, of course, that he wasn't also a puppet of the Aes Sedai. Soon they passed beyond the skeletal gray trees, reaching ones that were more ordinary. These still had yellowed leaves, too many dead branches, but that was better than the fuzz. About an hour later, Galad noted Child Barlet returning. The scout was a lean man, scarred on one cheek. Galad held up a hand as the man approached.
What word?
Barlet saluted with arm to chest.
The swamp dries out and the trees thin in about 1 mile, my lord Captain Commander. The field beyond is open and empty, the way clear to the north.
Light be thanked, Galad thought. He nodded to Barlet, and the man hurried back through the trees. Galad glanced back at the line of men. They were muddied, sweaty, and fatigued. But still, they were a grand sight, their armor replaced, their faces determined. They had followed him through this pit of a swamp. They were good men.
Pass the word to the other lords, Captain Trom, Galad said. Have them send word to their legions. We'll be out of this in under an hour.
The older man smiled, looking as relieved as Galad felt. Galad continued onward, jaw set against the pain of his leg. The cut was well bound, and there was little danger of further damage. It was painful, but pain could be dealt with.
Finally free of this bog.
He would need to plot their next course carefully, staying away from any towns, major roads, or estates held by influential lords. He ran through the maps in his head, maps memorized before his 10th name day. He was thus engaged when the yellow canopy thinned, clouded sunlight peeking between branches. Soon he caught sight of Barlet waiting at the edge of the line of trees. The forest ended abruptly, almost as neat as a line on a map. Galad sighed in relief, relishing the thought of being out in the open again. He stepped from the trees. Only then did an enormous force of troops begin to appear, climbing over a rise directly to his right. Armor clanged, horses whinnying as thousands of soldiers lined up atop the rise. Some were children in their plate and mail, with conical helms shined to perfection. Their pristine tabards and cloaks shone, sunbursts glittering at the breasts, lances raised in ranks. The larger number were foot soldiers, not wearing the white of the children, but instead simply brown leathers. Amadisians, likely provided by the Shanshan. Many had bows. Galad stumbled back, hand going to his sword. But he knew, immediately, that he had been trapped. Not a few of the children wore clothing adorned with the crook of the hand of the light. The questioners. If ordinary children were aflame to burn away evil, the questioners were a raging bonfire. Galad did a quick count. 3,000 to 4,000 children, and at least another 6,000 to 8,000 foot, half of those with bows. 10,000 fresh troops. His heart sank. Trom, Bornhald, and Biar hastened out of the forest behind Galad, along with a group of other children. Trom cursed softly. "So," Galad said, turning to the scout Barlet, "you are a traitor?"
"You are the traitor, child Damodred," the scout replied, face hard.
"Yes," Galad said. "I suppose it could be perceived that way." This march through the swamp had been suggested by his scouts. Galad could see now. It had been a delaying tactic, a way for Asinawa to get ahead of Galad. The march had also left Galad's men tired, while Asinawa's force was fresh and ready for battle. A sword scraped in its sheath. Galad immediately raised a hand without turning.
"Peace, child Biar."
Biar would have been the one to reach for his weapon, probably to strike down Barlet. Perhaps something of this could be salvaged. Galad made his decision swiftly.
"Child Biar and child Bornhold, you are with me. Trom, you and the other Lord's captain bring our men out onto the field here in ranks."
A large cluster of men near the front of Asinawa's force was riding forward, down the hillside. Many wore the crook of the questioners. They could have sprung their ambush and killed Galad's group quickly. Instead, they sent down a group to parley. That was a good sign. Galad mounted, avoiding a wince from his wounded leg. Biar and Bornhald mounted as well, and they followed him onto the field, hoofbeats muffled by the thick, yellowed grass. Asinawa himself was among the group approaching. He had thick, graying eyebrows and was so thin as to appear a doll made of sticks, with fabric stretched across them to imitate skin. Asinawa was not smiling. He rarely did. Galad pulled his horse up before the High Inquisitor. Asinawa was surrounded by a small guard of his questioners, but was also accompanied by 5 lords captain, each of whom Galad had met with, or served under, during his short time in the children. Asinawa leaned forward in his saddle, sunken eyes narrowing.
"Your rebels form ranks. Tell them to stand down or my archers will loose."
"Surely you would not ignore the rules of formal engagement," Galad said. "You would draw arrows upon men as they form ranks? Where is your honor?"
"Dark friends deserve no honor," Asinawa snapped. "Nor do they deserve pity."
"You name us dark friends, then?" Galad asked, turning his mount slightly. "All 7,000 children who were under Valda's command? Men your soldiers have served with, eaten with, known and fought beside? Men you yourself watched over not 2 months ago?"
Asinawa hesitated. Naming 7,000 of the children as dark friends would be ridiculous. It would mean that 2 out of every 3 remaining children had gone to the shadow.
"No," Asinawa said. "Perhaps they are simply misguided. Even a good man can stray down shadowed paths if his leaders are dark friends."
"I am no dark friend," Galad met Asinawa's eyes.
"Submit to my questioning and prove it."
"The Lord Captain Commander submits himself to no one," Galad said.
Under the light, I order you to stand down.
Asinawa laughed.
Child, we hold a knife to your throat. This is your chance to surrender.
Gulliver,
Galad said, looking at the Lord Captain at Asinawa's left. Gulliver was a lanky, bearded man, as hard as they came, but he was also fair.
Tell me, do the Children of the Light surrender?
Gulliver shook his head.
We do not. The Light will prove us victorious. And if we face superior odds?
Galad asked.
We fight on. And if we are tired and sore?
The Light will protect us, Gulliver said.
And if it is our time to die, then so be it. Let us take as many enemies with us as we may.
Galad turned back to Asinawa.
You see that I am in a predicament. To fight is to let you name us dark friends, but to surrender is to deny our oaths. By my honor as the Lord Captain Commander, I can accept neither option.
Asinawa's expression darkened.
You are not the Lord Captain Commander. He is dead.
By my hand,
Galad said, unsheathing his weapon, holding it forward so that the herons gleamed in the light.
And I hold his sword. Do you deny that you yourself watched me face Volda in fair combat as prescribed by law?
As by the law, perhaps, Asinawa said. But I would not call that fight fair. You drew on the powers of shadow. I saw you standing in darkness despite the daylight, and I saw the dragon's fangs sprout on your forehead. Volda never had a chance.
Honish,
Galad said, turning to the Lord Captain to the right of Asinawa. He was a short man, bald, missing one ear from fighting Dragonsworn.
Tell me, is the shadow stronger than the light?
Of course not,
the man said, spitting to the side.
If the Lord Captain Commander's cause had been honorable, would he have fallen to me in a battle under the light? If I were a dark friend, could I have slain the Lord Captain Commander himself?
Harnish didn't answer, but Galad could almost see the thoughts in his head. The shadow might display strength at times, but the light always revealed and destroyed it. It was possible for the Lord Captain Commander to fall to a dark friend. It was possible for any man to fall. But in a duel before the other children, a duel for honor under the light.
Sometimes the shadow displays cunning and strength,
Asinawa cut in before Galad could continue to question.
At times, good men die.
You all know what Volda did,
Galad said.
My mother is dead. Is there an argument against my right to challenge him?
You have no rights as a dark friend. I will parley no more with you, murderer.
Asinawa waved a hand, and several of his questioners drew swords. Immediately, Galad's companions did the same. Behind, he could hear his weary forces hastily closing their ranks.
What will happen to us, Asinawa, if child fights child?
Galad asked softly.
I will not surrender, and I would not attack you. But perhaps we can reunite. Not as enemies, but as brothers, separated for a time.
I will never associate with dark friends,
Asinawa said, though he sounded hesitant. He watched Galad's men. Asinawa would win a battle, but if Galad's men stood their ground, it would be a costly victory. Both sides would lose thousands.
I will submit to you, Galad said. On certain terms.
No!
Bornhold said from behind, but Galad raised a hand, silencing him.
What terms would those be?
Asinawa asked.
You swear, before the light and the Lord's captain here with you, that you will not harm, question, or otherwise condemn the men who followed me. They were only doing what they thought was right.
Asinawa's eyes narrowed, his lips forming a straight line.
That includes my companions here, Galad said, nodding to Biar and Bornhold. Every man, Asinawa. They must never know questioning.
You cannot hinder the hand of the light in such a way. This would give them free rein to seek the shadow.
And is it only fear of questioning that keeps us in the light, Asunawa? Galad asked. Are not the children valiant and true? Asunawa fell silent. Galad closed his eyes, feeling the weight of leadership. Each moment he stalled increased the bargaining position for his men. He opened his eyes. The last battle comes, Asunawa. We haven't time for squabbling. The dragon reborn walks the land.
Heresy,
Asunawa said. Yes, Galad said. And truth as well. Asunawa ground his teeth but seemed to be considering the offer.
Galad,
Bornhold said softly.
Don't do this. We can fight. The light will protect us.
If we fight, we will kill good men, Child Bornhold, Galad said without turning. Each stroke of our swords will be a blow for the Dark One. The children are the only true foundation that this world has left. We are needed. If my life is what is demanded to bring unity, then so be it. You would do the same, I believe.
He met Asunawa's eyes.
Take him,
Asunawa snapped, looking dissatisfied.
And tell the legions to stand down. Inform them that I have taken the false Lord Captain Commander into custody and will question him to determine the extent of his crimes.
He hesitated.
But also pass the word that those who followed him are not to be punished or questioned.
Asunawa spun his horse and rode away. Galad turned his sword and handed it out to Bornhold.
Return to our men. Tell them what happened here and do not let them fight or try to rescue me. That is an order.
Bornhold met his eyes, then slowly took the sword. At last he saluted.
Yes, my Lord Captain Commander.
As soon as they turned to ride away, rough hands grabbed Galad and pulled him from Stout's saddle. He hit the ground with a grunt, his bad shoulder throwing a spike of agony across his chest. He tried to climb to his feet, but several questioners dismounted and knocked him down again. One forced Galad to the ground, a boot on his back, and Galad heard the metallic rasp of a knife being unsheathed. They cut his clothing free.
You will not wear the uniform of a child of the light, Dark Friend,
a questioner said in his ear.
I am not a Dark Friend,
Galad said, face pressed to the grassy earth.
I will never speak that lie. I walk in the light.
That earned him a kick to the side, then another and another. He curled up, grunting, but the blows continued to fall. Finally, the darkness took him.
The creature that had once been Padan Fane walked down the side of a hill. The brown weeds grew in broken patches, like the scrub on the chin of a beggar. The sky was black, a tempest. He liked that, though he hated the one who caused it. Hatred. It was the proof that he still lived, the one emotion left, the only emotion. It was all that there could be. Consuming, thrilling, beautiful, warming, violent hatred. Wonderful. It was the storm that gave him strength, the purpose that drove him. Althor would die, by his hand. And perhaps after that, the Dark One. Wonderful. The creature who had been Padan Fane fingered his beautiful dagger, feeling the edges of the designs in the fine golden wire that wrapped its hilt. A large ruby capped the end of its hilt, and he carried the weapon unsheathed in his right hand so that the blade extended between his first two fingers. The sides of those fingers had been cut a dozen times over. Blood dripped from the tip of the dagger down onto the weeds, crimson spots to cheer him. Red below, black above. Perfect. Did his hatred cause that storm? It must be so. Yes. The drops of blood fell alongside spots of darkness that appeared on dead leaves and stems as he moved farther north into the blight. He was mad. That was good. When you accepted madness into yourself, embraced it and drank it in as if it were sunlight or water or the air itself, it became another part of you, like a hand or an eye. You could see by madness. You could hold things with madness. It was wonderful, liberating. He was finally free. The creature who had been Mordith reached the bottom of the hill and did not look back at the large purplish mass that he'd left atop it. Worms were very messy to kill the right way, but some things needed to be done the right way. It was the principle of the thing. Mist had begun to trail him, creeping up from the ground. Was that mist his madness, or was it his hatred? It was so familiar. It twisted around his ankles and licked at his heels. Something peeked around a hillside nearby, then ducked back. Worms died loudly. Worms did everything loudly. A pack of worms could destroy an entire legion. When you heard them, you went the other way, quickly. But then it could be advantageous to send scouts to go judge the direction of the pack, lest you continue on and run across it again elsewhere. So the creature that had been Padan Fane was not surprised when he rounded the hillside and found a nervous group of Trollocs there, a Murdrawl guiding them. He smiled. My friends. It had been too long. It took a moment for their brutish brains to come to the obvious, but false, conclusion. If a man was wandering around, then worms couldn't be near. Those would have smelled his blood and come for him. Worms preferred humans over Trollocs. That made sense. The creature who had been Mordith had tasted both, and Trolloc flesh had little to recommend it. The Trollocs tore forward in a mismatched pack. Feathers, beaks, claws, teeth, tusks. The creature that had been Fane stood still, mist licking his unshod feet. How wonderful! At the very back of the group, the Murdrawl hesitated, its eyeless gaze fixed on him. Perhaps it sensed that something was terribly, terribly wrong. And right, of course. You couldn't be one without the other. That wouldn't make sense. The creature that had been Mordith, he would need a new name soon, smiled deeply. The Murdrawl turned to run away. The mist struck. It rolled over the Trollocs, moving quickly like the tentacles of a leviathan in the Arith Ocean. Lengths of it snapped forward through Trolloc chests. One long rope whipped above their heads, then shot forward in a blur, taking the fade in the neck. The Trollocs screamed, dropping, spasming. Their hair fell out in patches and their skin began to boil. Blisters and cysts. When those popped, they left crater-like pox in the Shadow Spawn's skin, like bubbles on the surface of metal that cooled too quickly. The creature that had been Padan Fane opened his mouth in glee, closing his eyes to the tumultuous black sky, and raising his face, lips parted, enjoying his feast. After it passed, he sighed, holding his dagger tighter, cutting his flesh. Red below, black above. Red and black. Red and black. So much red and black. Wonderful. He walked on through the blight. The corrupted Trollocs climbed to their feet behind him, lurching into motion, spittle dropping from their lips. Their eyes had grown sluggish and dull, but when he desired it, they would respond with a frenzied battle lust that would surpass what they had known in life. He left the Murdrawl. It would not rise, as rumors said they did. His touch now brought instant death to one of its kind. Pity. He had a few nails he might have otherwise put to good use. Perhaps he should get some gloves. But if he did, he couldn't cut his hand. What a problem. No matter. Onward. The time had come to kill Althor. It saddened him that the hunt must end. But there was no longer a reason for a hunt. You didn't hunt something when you knew exactly where it was going to be. You merely showed up to meet it. Like an old friend. A dear, beloved old friend that you were going to stab through the eye, open at the gut, and consume by handfuls while drinking his blood. That was the proper way to treat friends. It was an honor. Malinaran Rai shuffled through supply reports. That blasted shutter on the window behind his desk snapped and blew open again, letting in the damp heat of the blight. Despite 10 years serving as commander of Heath Tower, he hadn't grown accustomed to the heat in the highlands. Damp, muggy, the air often full of rotting scents. The whistling wind rattled the wooden shutter. He rose, walking over to pull it shut, then twisted a bit of twine around its handle to keep it closed. He walked back to his desk, looking over the roster of newly arrived soldiers. Each name had a specialty beside it. Up here, every soldier had to fill 2 or more duties. Skill at binding wounds, swift feet for running messages, a keen eye with a bow, the ability to make the same old mush taste like new mush. Malinaran always asked specifically for men in the last group. Any cook who could make soldiers eager to come to mess was worth his weight in gold. Malinaran set aside his current report, weighing it down with the lead-filled trolloc horn he kept for the purpose. The next sheet in his stack was a letter from a man named Baraga, a merchant who was bringing his caravan to the tower to trade. Malinaran smiled. He was a soldier first, but he wore the 3 silver chains across his chest that marked him as a master merchant. While his tower received many of its supplies directly from the queen, no Kandori commander was denied the opportunity to barter with merchants. If he was lucky, he'd be able to get this outlander merchant drunk at the bargaining table. Malinaran had forced more than one merchant into a year of military service as penance for entering bargains he could not keep. A year of training with the queen's forces often did plump foreign merchants a great deal of good. He set that sheet beneath the trolloc horn, then hesitated as he saw the last item for his attention at the bottom of the stack. It was a reminder from his steward. Keemlin, his eldest son, was approaching his 14th name day. As if Malinaran could forget about that. He needed no reminder. He smiled, setting the trolloc horn on the note in case that shutter broke open again. He'd slain the trolloc who had borne that horn himself. Then he walked over to the side of his office and opened his battered oak trunk. Among the other effects inside was a cloth-wrapped sword. The brown scabbard kept well-oiled and maintained, but faded with time. His father's sword. In 3 days, he would give it to Keemlin. A boy became a man on his 14th name day, the day he was given his first sword and became responsible for himself. Keemlin had worked hard to learn his forms under the harshest trainers Malinaran could provide. Soon his son would become a man. How quickly the years passed. Taking a proud breath, Malinaran closed the trunk, then rose and left his office for his daily rounds. The tower housed 250 soldiers, a bastion of defense that watched the blight. To have a duty was to have pride, just as to bear a burden was to gain strength. Watching the blight was his duty and his strength, and it was particularly important these days, with the strange storm to the north, and with the queen and much of the Kandori army having marched to seek the dragon reborn. He pulled the door to his office closed, then threw the hidden latch that barred it on the other side. It was one of several such doors in the hallway. An enemy storming the tower wouldn't know which one opened onto the stairwell upward. In this way, a small office could function as part of the tower defense. He walked to the stairwell. These top levels were not accessible from the ground level. The entire bottom 40 feet of the tower was a trap. An enemy who entered at the ground floor and climbed up 3 flights of garrison quarters would discover no way up to the 4th floor. The only way to go to the 4th level
was to climb a narrow, collapsible ramp on the outside of the tower that led from the second level up to the fourth. Running on it left attackers fully exposed to arrows from above. Then, once some of them were up but others not, the Kandori would collapse the ramp, dividing the enemy force and leaving those above to be killed as they tried to find the interior stairwells. Molinaran climbed at a brisk pace. Periodic slits to the sides of the steps looked down on the stairs beneath and would allow archers to fire on invaders. When he was about halfway to the top, he heard hasty footfalls coming down. A second later, Jargon, sergeant of the watch, rounded the bend. Like most Kandori, Jargon wore a forked beard. His black hair was dusted with gray. Jargon had joined the Blight Watch the day after his 14th name day. He wore a cord looped around the shoulder of his brown uniform. It bore a knot for each Trolloc he'd killed. There had to be approaching 50 knots in the thing by now. Jargon saluted with arm to breast, then lowered his hand to rest on his sword, a sign of respect for his commander. In many countries, holding the weapon like that would be an insult, but Southerners were known to be peevish and ill-tempered. Couldn't they see that it was an honor to hold your sword and imply you found your commander a worthy threat?
My lord, Jargon said, voice gruff. A flash from Rena Tower.
What?
Molinaran asked. The two fell into step, trotting up the stairwell.
It was distinct, sir, Jargon said. Saw it myself, I did. Only a flash, but it was there.
Did they send a correction?
They may have by now. I ran to fetch you first.
If there had been more news, Jargon would have shared it, so Molinaran did not waste breath pressing him. Shortly, they stepped onto the top of the tower, which held an enormous mechanism of mirrors and lamps. With the apparatus, the tower could send messages to the east or west, where other towers lined the Blight, or southward along a line of towers that ran to the Ace Daishar Palace in Chachin. The vast, undulating Kandori Highlands spread out from his tower. Some of the southern hills were still lightly laced with morning fog. That land to the south, free of this unnatural heat, would soon grow green, and Kandori herdsmen would climb to the high pastures to graze their sheep. Northward lay the Blight. Molinaran had read of days when the Blight had barely been visible from this tower. Now it ran nearly to the base of the stonework. Rena Tower was northwest as well. Its commander, Lord Nyok of House Okotomo, was a distant cousin and a good friend. He would not have sent a flash without reason, and would send a retraction if it had been an accident.
Any further word?
Molinaran asked. The soldiers on watch shook their heads. Jargon tapped his foot, and Molinaran folded his arms to wait for a correction. Nothing came. Rena Tower stood within the Blight these days, as it was farther north than Heath Tower. Its position within the Blight was normally not an issue. Even the most fearsome creatures of the Blight knew not to attack a Kandori tower. No correction came. Not a glimmer.
Send a message to Rena, Molinaran said. Ask if their flash was a mistake. Then ask Farme Tower if they have noticed anything strange.
Jargon set the men to work, but gave Molinaran a flat glance as if to ask, You think I haven't done that already? That meant messages had been sent, but there was no word back. Wind blew across the tower top, creaking the steel of the mirror apparatus as his men sent another series of flashes. That wind was humid. Far too hot. Molinaran glanced upward toward where that same black storm boiled and rolled. It seemed to have settled down. That struck him as very discomforting.
Flash a message backward, Molinaran said. Toward the inland towers. Tell them what we saw. Tell them to be ready in case of trouble.
The men set to work.
Sergeant, Molinaran said. Who is next on the messenger roster?
The tower force included a small group of boys who were excellent riders. Lightweight, they could go on fast horses should a commander decide to bypass the mirrors. Mirror light was fast, but it could be seen by one's enemies. Besides, if the line of towers was broken, or if the apparatus was damaged, they would need a means to get word to the capital.
Next on the roster,
Jargon said, checking a list nailed to the inside of the door onto the rooftop.
It would be Keimlin, my lord. Keimlin. His Keimlin.
Molinaran glanced to the northwest, toward the silent tower that had flashed so ominously.
Bring me word if there is a hint of response from the other towers, Molinaran said to the soldiers. Jargon, come with me.
The two of them hurried down the stairs. We need to send a messenger southward, Molinaran said, then hesitated.
No. No, we need to send several messengers. Double up, just in case the towers fall.
He began moving again. The two of them left the stairwell and entered Molinaran's office. He grabbed his best quill off the rack on his wall. That blasted shutter was blowing and rattling again. The papers on his desk rustled as he pulled out a fresh sheet of paper.
Rena and Farme not responding to flash messages. Possibly overrun or severely hampered. Be advised. Heath will stand.
He folded the paper, holding it up to Jargon. The man took it with a leathery hand, read it over, then grunted.
Two copies, then?
Three, Molinaran said. Mobilize the archers and send them to the roof. Tell them danger may come from above.
If he wasn't merely jumping at shadows, if the towers to either side of Heath had fallen so quickly, then those to the south could fall as quickly. And if he'd been the one making an assault, he'd have done anything he could to sneak around and take out one of the southern towers first. That was the best way to make sure no messages got back to the capital. Jargon saluted, fist to chest, then withdrew. The message would be sent immediately. Three times on legs of horseflesh, once on legs of light. Molinaran let himself feel a hint of relief that his son was one of those riding to safety. There was no dishonor in that. The messages needed to be delivered, and Keimlin was next on the roster. Molinaran glanced out his window. It faced north, toward the blight. Every commander's office did that. The bubbling storm, with its silvery clouds. Sometimes they looked like straight geometric shapes. He had listened well to passing merchants. Troubled times were coming. The queen would not have gone south to seek a false dragon, no matter how cunning or influential he might be. She believed. It was time for Tarmon Gaiden. And looking out into that storm, Molinaran thought he could see to the very edge of time itself. An edge that was not far distant. In fact, it seemed to be growing darker. And there was a darkness beneath it, on the ground northward. That darkness was advancing. Molinaran dashed out of the room, racing up the steps to the roof, where the wind swept against men pushing and moving mirrors.
Was the message sent to the south? He demanded.
Yes, sir,
Lieutenant Landolin said. He'd been roused to take command of the tower's top.
No reply yet.
Molinaran glanced down and picked out three riders breaking away from the tower at full speed. The messengers were off. They would stop at Barklin if it wasn't being attacked. The captain there would send them on southward just in case. And if Barklin didn't stand, the boys would continue on, all the way to the capital if needed. Molinaran turned back to the storm. That advancing darkness had him on edge. It was coming.
Raise the hoardings, he ordered Landolin. Bring up the store hitchings and empty the cellars. Have the loaders gather all of the arrows and set up stations for resupplying the archers and put archers at every choke point, kill slit, and window. Start the fire pots and have men ready to drop the outer ramps. Prepare for a siege.
As Landolin barked orders, men rushed away. Molinaran heard boots scrape stone behind him, and he glanced over his shoulder. Was that Jargon back again? No. It was a youth of nearly 14 summers, too young for a beard, his dark hair disheveled, his face streaming with sweat, caused presumably by a run up 7 levels of the tower. Keimlin. Molinaran felt a stab of fear, instantly replaced with anger.
Soldier, you were to ride with a message.
Keimlin bit his lip.
Well, sir, he said. Tion, 4 places down from me. He is 5, maybe 10 pounds lighter than I am. It makes a big difference, sir. He rides a lot faster, and I figured this would be an important message. So I asked for him to be sent in my place.
Molinaran frowned. Soldiers moved around them, rushing down the stairs or gathering with bows at the rim of the tower. The wind howled outside, and thunder began to sound softly, yet insistently. Keemlin met his eyes.
Tion's mother, Lady Yabeth, has lost 4 sons to the Blight, he said, softly enough that only Molinaran could hear. Tion's the only one she has left. If one of us has a shot at getting out, sir, I figured it should be him.
Molinaran held his son's eyes. The boy understood what was coming. Light help him, but he understood. And he'd sent another away in his place.
Krell!
Molinaran barked, glancing toward one of the soldiers passing by.
Yes, my lord commander?
Run down to my office, Molinaran said. There is a sword in my oaken trunk. Fetch it for me.
The man saluted, obeying.
Father, Keemlin said, my name day isn't for 3 days.
Molinaran waited with arms behind his back. His most important task at the moment was to be seen in command, to reassure his troops. Krell returned with the sword. Its worn scabbard bore the image of the oak set aflame, the symbol of House Bry.
Father?
Keemlin repeated.
This weapon is offered to a boy when he becomes a man, Molinaran said. It seems it is too late in coming, son, for I see a man standing before me.
He held the weapon forward in his right hand. Around the tower top, soldiers turned toward him. The archers with bows ready, the soldiers who operated the mirrors, the duty watchmen. As borderlanders, each and every one of them would have been given his sword on his 14th name day. Each one had felt the same catch in the chest, the wonderful feeling of coming of age. It had happened to each of them, but that did not make this occasion any less special. Keemlin went down on one knee.
Why do you draw your sword?
Molinaran asked, voice loud so that every man atop the tower would hear.
In defense of my honor, my family, or my homeland, Keemlin replied.
How long do you fight?
Until my last breath joins the northern winds.
When do you stop watching?
Never,
Keemlin whispered.
Speak it louder.
Never.
Once this sword is drawn, you become a warrior. Always wear it near you in preparation to fight the shadow. Will you draw this blade and join us as a man?
Keemlin looked up, then took the hilt in a firm grip and pulled the weapon free.
Rise as a man, my son,
Molinaran declared. Keemlin stood, holding the weapon aloft, the bright blade reflecting the diffuse sunlight. The men atop the tower cheered. It was no shame to find tears in one's eyes at such a moment. Molinaran blinked them free, then knelt down, buckling the sword belt at his son's waist. The men continued to cheer and yell, and he knew it was not only for his son. They yelled in defiance of the shadow. For a moment, their voices rang louder than the thunder. Molinaran stood, laying a hand on his son's shoulder as the boy slid his sword into its sheath. Together they turned to face the oncoming shadow.
There,
one of the archers said, pointing upward.
There's something in the clouds.
Drakkar,
another one said. The unnatural clouds were close now, and the shade they cast could no longer hide the undulating horde of Trollocs beneath. Something flew out of the sky, but a dozen of his archers let loose. The creature screamed and fell, dark wings flapping awkwardly. Jargon pushed his way through to Molinaran.
My lord, Jargon said, shooting a glance at Keemlin. The boy should be below.
Not a boy any longer, Molinaran said with pride. A man. What is your report?
All is prepared.
Jargon glanced over the wall, eyeing the oncoming Trollocs as evenly as if he were inspecting a stable of horses.
They will not find this tree an easy one to fell.
Molinaran nodded. Keemlin's shoulder was tense. That sea of Trollocs seemed endless. Against this foe, the tower would eventually fall. The Trollocs would keep coming, wave after wave. But every man atop that tower knew his duty. They'd kill Shadow Spawn as long as they could, hoping to buy enough time for the messages to do some good. Molinaran was a man of the Borderlands, same as his father, same as his son beside him. They knew their task. You held until you were relieved. That's all there was to it.